and welcome to The Thing About Cars. I'm one of your hosts, Mickey Desai. Around the table today, we have a good crew today. We've got Misty. How are you doing, Misty?
Doing fantastic.
And Dave. Dave, how are you, sir?
I have celebrated No Pants Day this week, so I'm riding well. Thanks.
When was No Pants Day?
Yesterday. Yes, Friday. Friday was National No Pants Day.
I missed it. Dang it. Oh, all right. Ben, how are you, Ben?
I'm pretty well. How about you?
I'm good, sir. Who's our guest for today, Ben?
Well, today we have Paul Harmon, the owner of a Mercedes that has gone over 1,000,000 miles. And this is a car that I spotted on the interstate one day. It had a big banner in the back window that, if I can look at my picture here, it said 1,199,017 miles. And that sparked my curiosity. So I just did a little looking online and I found who owned the car. And here he is. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. How y'all doing? Oh, good afternoon, brother.
Well, I don't know.
Either way,
we're happy. So I'm sure we all have plenty of questions for Paul regarding his Mercedes, but I think let's ask our trivia question first. Misty has the trivia question for the day. Misty, what have you got?
I do. If the fastest vehicle produced each year was put on an infinitely straight track on the first day of the year it was produced and raced at its top speed indefinitely, which car would be in the lead? Would that be the 2005 Bugatti Veyron, the 1967 Lambo Mira, the 1987 Ferrari F40, or the 1959 Aston Martin DB4 GT?
That's crazy. All right, so wait a minute. Ask that again so I make sure I'm imagining the right thing here.
Produced each year was put on an infinitely straight track on the first day of the year it was produced and raced at its top speed indefinitely, which car would currently be in the lead? The 1987 Ferrari F40, the 1967 Lambo Mira, the 1959 Aston Martin DB4 GT, or the 2005 Bugatti Veyron?
I love it. I love the question. Thank you.
Well, I do have to go on record of saying I didn't think this hard about my thesis.
I mean, it's a math problem, right? I think it's just a math problem. But
a train should leave Chicago traveling 25 miles an hour.
All right, Misty. Thank you. It's an excellent question. Can't wait to answer it. Ben, would you take it away with our guest and get us started on the Mercedes conversation?
Yeah, well, it all started a few weeks ago. I was on one of my business trips. I was coming back into Atlanta from points eastward, and I was coming up on my exit, and I saw this yellow Mercedes, a 240D, I think, up ahead of me, taking the same exit. And I noticed it because that's not a car you see a lot of these days. And then I saw the banner in the rear window that said it had all these miles on it. And I thought, that's got to be interesting. There's got to be a good story here. We should talk with this guy. You do a search on 1,000,000 mile Mercedes and it's not hard to find. I found some YouTube videos and magazine articles that had a handful of people in them with 1,000,000 mile cars. And so I think we've got an esteemed guest who's in rare company with us today. My first question is, how did it start? Did you surely you weren't thinking when you bought this car you were going to drive 1,000,000 miles in it?
And I had no idea how long I would keep the car, how long I would, you know, how many miles I would put on it. It just became my daily driver, and I just started driving it. And quite frankly, when I reached the 500,000 mile mark, I just kind of said to myself, do I have something I want to continue to go with, or is it time to trade it in?
Because nothing had really broken by that point, right?
No, nothing had broken.
Wow.
I may have put in a starter or two but maybe one or two windshields, and because you catch debris and rocks and, you know, you get all that on the highway, obviously, everybody knows that. And it was getting close to being due a paint job. And quite frankly, I think I painted it for the first time around, it was before 600,000 miles. I'm positive of that. And I can go back and, you know, look all that up. But when I hit the 500,000 mile mark, I made a decision. I'm going to go for it. And because I needed to put a little money into it, and I did, and I'm glad I did. And here we are. So,
yeah, those are great cars. They're pretty tough, I understand, you know, to begin with. So
absolutely. It I think it would take most anything. That four speed manual stick shift. Man, I just loved it. I jumped in that thing and I test drove it obviously before I purchased it. And I said, and I went through the 4 years and I said, man, I'm where I need to be. So
that's got the diesel engine, right?
I was guessing you've got a diesel, right?
Yeah, a little 4-cylinder diesel.
Yeah, those are real tough those engines. Those
are indestructible.
Yeah.
My vehicle was manufactured. It's called the 123 body style.
Right.
It was manufactured from 1976 through 1985. It's the 123 body style. My car, the last year it was manufactured, it's a 123 body, the 240D, but it stopped. The last year of manufacture was 1983. So it went from 76 to 83. That's what, 7 or so years of manufacturing. They produced in Germany for the U.S. market 488,000, almost 449,000 240Ds in that 7 or 8 year period. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
To me, that's unbelievable.
That's crazy.
They used to be all over this.
They did, yeah. And, I remember them.
They were a favorite car of realtors.
Yes.
Yes.
And I'll tell you something else. My odometer quit working last May or so. So, you know, if my odometer doesn't work, man, I'm out of business.
Yeah.
Got to get that fixed.
That's right. So I went and let my handy Mercedes guy look at it and says, okay, you need this little gear that fits into the transmission and we'll, you know, replace that gear. It's about $31 item, probably $100 to put it in or whatever. 4 months later, I end up being the proud owner of a used Mercedes-Benz 240D transmission.
Oh. Ah.
Because the only way you can buy that little $31 gear is to buy a $700 transmission.
Nice.
That includes the gear.
That's crazy.
Well, if the gauge itself ever develops a problem, I can recommend somebody to fix that.
The what?
If the gauge itself, if the instrument in the dashboard fails, I know a guy in Georgia who does very good work on all kinds of odometers, tachometers, speedometers, all that stuff.
Yeah, I may have used him before, quite frankly, because
probably.
My odometer has quit on about 4 or 5 different occasions. So I probably have 5 to 10,000 more miles on this car because of time spent between getting that repair done.
Right.
Well, if you'd driven me a million miles, I'd be tired too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know that for many years when the Mercedes cars in Europe would wear out, you know, when the Europeans decided they'd put enough miles on them, they'd ship them down to Africa where, you know, they'd bump around down there for years and years and years, you know, after that, probably without even the kind of care you can get, you know, in the United States.
Didn't you say earlier that you were the second owner?
Yes, I'm the second owner. This car was originally sold on March the 27th, 1981. I got all the paperwork, and the window sticker and all that good stuff. And I purchased it on May the 31st, 1983. And it had just over 40,000 miles. And what's so interesting in all my paperwork here, I have a list of all the used cars that the dealership had for sale that day. And my car is listed on it, of course. And right beside it in parentheses, it had the number 40. And a couple other cars had like 2-4 in parentheses by their, you know, vehicle. And one of them had 24M. I figured that was 24,000 miles. So that's how I came up recalling the 40,000. And it actually had closer to like 41.5. I remember clear. Oh yeah, and here's a big deal. At least it's a big deal for me. On March the 26th of this year, since I saw Ben, the car turned 1,200,000 miles.
Awesome.
That is one day before it was sold 40 years earlier. And if you do the math, that's 30,000 miles a year for 40 years.
That's crazy.
The first owner had it for 2 years, put on about 40. I put on the rest, and it was just, I mean, I went back and looked at those dates, and I said, that is, like you said, that's crazy.
Yeah. So so you're not doing like marathon road trips in it or anything. It remains a daily driver. Any secrets? I mean, besides regular maintenance and besides it being an indestructible diesel engine, any secrets, any care tips? What would you say? What would you contribute the longevity of the car to?
Well, I think it's gotta be, I started out according to the book, oil changes every 5,000 miles. My, trusted diesel mechanic said, Paul, if you want to put a lot of miles on this car, this is around 300,000 miles. He told me this. He said, we need to convert back to every 3,000 miles oil change.
Interesting.
So that's what I did. And tomorrow I'm going to have my 353rd oil change on that car.
Wow.
And the list price of the vehicle, brand new, was $21,792.
Okay.
All right.
Yep.
Do the math for, say, let's just say way back when oil changes were like maybe $40. Now they're like $140. You do the math, say $70 an oil change for all of those oil changes. I have spent more on oil changes on this car than it costs brand new.
That's
wow, yeah.
Well, as long as we're also doing the math, if you've broken 1.2 million miles, you've actually made two complete round trips to the moon and back, and you're actually have circled the moon a third time and are starting coming back.
That's right.
You're exactly right. And if you, I think if you say, because I've done that math as well, I think you say if I got in that car and started driving it at 60 miles an hour, and don't let off, and when it hit 1.2 million, I think you'd say I would have driven it for 833.3 days, 24-hour day.
See what you've done, Misty? You start a show with a story problem, and it's nothing but math.
and just for the record, I am like absolute pants at math. Like I take my shoes off to count to 20. I'm bad at math.
Well, that brings me to a question. When I saw your car on the highway, the banner in the rear window said 1,199,017 miles. That seems like a really odd figure to bother to print on a banner. Why that number?
Well, I only change that banner every 1,000 miles.
Okay.
And the number 17 is near and dear to my heart. Because that was my number when I played sports in high school and college.
Oh.
So the number 17 will not be changed. Just a 1,000-mile number changes every time.
Oh, that's pretty cool, actually. You should send a picture of that to Germany because, you know, the oddness of the number will make German heads explode.
Pretty much. Pretty much. It. And I'm speaking from experience. So where'd you go to college?
University of South Carolina.
Gamecocks. Yeah.
I grew up in a little town by the name of Lexington, South Carolina. That's where I live today. And in my business career, I worked with Bell South for 31 years or so. And we moved around and I spent a lot of time in Atlanta. And 13 years ago, I think it was 13 years ago. Yeah. We decided to move back to South Carolina to be with family and that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah. Paul, do you have a web page for your car or anything for people to check it out?
No, I don't. I do not have a web page. Maybe
I was just curious.
We can make it happen.
Yeah, it's easy enough to do just a little bit of celebrity and just a thought. I just did not know if you had a web presence or not.
Well,
Paul,
a granddaughter that's very very smart in building web pages and those kinds of things. Obviously, she didn't get that from me because I couldn't hardly sign on for the show. but I'll get her to look into it and see what we can. Thank you.
Might be a fun little project.
Yeah.
So, Paul, we always wrap the guest questions. We always wrap the guest segment with a handful of questions for you. So I've got four questions for you. The first three are standard, and the fourth one is sort of silly and random. You ready?
Ready.
Question number one, what is your dream car?
1981 Mercedes 240D.
Okay. That's
awesome.
It. You're driving.
That's it. I got it. I have no desire for any other vehicle. I'm going to ride it out.
That's fantastic.
That's what I think you should call your website, Driving Your Dream.
Driving Your Dream.
Thank you. Driving My Dream.
That's brilliant.
Thank you.
Question number two, where is your next road trip going to be?
My next road trip is to Amelia Island, 2 weeks from Friday. I'm in the, they accepted my vehicle to be in the coffee and cars show.
Right.
On Saturday, the 22nd of May. So I'll be at Amelia Island. Entrance on that particular day is free. So everyone should come.
Excellent. Question number three, Paul, what is the most fascinating thing you've seen on the road or in someone's garage?
Wow. I assume you mean vehicle, obviously.
Or not necessarily. No,
it doesn't have to be.
No.
Well, the most fascinating thing I've seen on the road is the Arctic Ocean. This car me and one of my brothers. We took it through the Dakotas, up through Canada, Alaska, the Dalton Highway, from Fairbanks on up to Prudhoe Bay. And it was one of those cases where you drive up to the Arctic Ocean and you got to turn around and come back at some point.
Yeah.
So the Arctic Ocean, even though that's not a real sexy thing, I don't think, but it meant a hell of a lot to me. Pardon my.
That is pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So our last question for you is the silly random question is, what is your favorite food?
My favorite food, I would say it's the ribeye steaks my wife fixes every Saturday evening. It's the best steak you've ever had in your life. She is good, by the way. She knows how to fix them.
So do you have space at the table for four guests this upcoming Saturday?
We got it.
Can somebody pick me up from the airport?
I got you, Misty.
Cool.
Excellent.
Well, because I have to tell you, it's kind of a running joke, you know, because out of all the people that are regularly on this podcast, which everybody's normally in Georgia, but I'm the only native born Georgian, but I'm in the Netherlands. So right. It's like
Misty gives us our local and our international cachet all at the same time.
Okay.
Part near. I'm a Raven County girl. I was born up in Raven County, and my mama was born up in Greenville.
Right. She is actually Raven County, Georgia's ambassador to the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And you said Greenville, you mean Greenville, South Carolina?
Yeah.
And that's where my car was at a dealership by the name of Snyder Motors in 1983 when I bought it. And Snyder Motors has been purchased, and it's now Carlton Motorsports, still a Mercedes dealer in Greenville, South Carolina. So that's where I purchased my vehicle.
Excellent.
Cool.
Paul, thank you for being our guest today. I hope you can remain with us for the remainder of the show. Just chime in on the conversation and have a good time with us. Thank you. Thank you again for being our guest.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity and the idea of getting putting a little website up. Who knows?
Something simple. Let's switch gears here and go to Dave. Dave's on the Autobahn today. Dave, what are we going to talk about?
So we're going to talk about the pickup truck. You know, first of all, I think it's worth saving. The segment is normally called Dawn on the Autobahn.
Yeah, yeah.
Dawn works incredibly difficult, and so she's taking a very well-deserved week-long vacation, and I spent an entire week trying to come up with some clever, different thing to call it. You know, the closest I could come was Dave Dents the Pavements, and that sounds too much like a Wile E. Coyote reference. So
it could work, though.
So it could work. Dave Dents the Pavements. We may use this for something else. If nothing else, it sounds like the name of a good garage band.
That's right.
So we've been chatting a little bit online in our inner family Facebook chat box this week, and I brought up something about pickups. Now, I spent a lot of my career traveling to Europe, working in Europe, and entertaining Europeans when they would come to the United States. And especially as I was schlepping them around Atlanta, conversation or the reference to the number of pickup trucks that they would see here was a interesting conversation, because especially for all the time I spent in Europe, you didn't see many pickup trucks. And pickup trucks, you know, at the time, I said, I always said, well, this is kind of a quintessentially American car. And even if you look at the statistics, historically, 98% of all of the pickup trucks sold in the world were sold in the United States and Canada. And I put this out there, and Misty immediately responded back that she had seen more than her share of Ford F-150s in Amsterdam, or in the Netherlands. Is that fair, Misty?
Yeah, it's usually a toss-up between the Ford F-150, I think the Dodge Ram, and you might see the Toyotas, but you don't see a lot of Chevys. There is somebody in this area, though, in where I'm at, that has one of the, I'm going to say, 60s, 70s Chevy trucks that's been restored. But there's also somebody that drives around here in a banana yellow El Camino, too. So
nice.
Car.
Well, and there are a lot of reasons why historically pickup trucks weren't popular in Europe. I mean, first of all, they didn't get as good a mileage as a lot of European cars did. And second, European cities tend to be closer together than United States cities are. So that hauling was not quite as big of an issue. And then, you're looking at like an F-250 or larger, finding a place to park it or store it in Europe, big challenge. However, there is, as I was going at this with my paradigm, Misty said, she's seeing trucks all over the place. There's actually a huge burgeoning market for American pickup trucks now, in particular in Europe. And overwhelmingly, the most popular truck for export around the world is the Ford F-Series truck. It's leading everybody else in the world. And so, there are not a lot of, homegrown pickup trucks in Europe. There's, if you've ever seen the Morris JE lineup of commercial vehicles, if not, Google it, because honest to God, it looks like somebody went and said, let's build a series of commercial vehicles that would look appropriate on a ZZ Top record cover.
I'm looking this up right now.
But
we usually have the little transit vans.
Yeah, transit vans are super, super popular there. And I start, saying, okay, why are Europeans buying more pickups? And some are partnering to get over there. But the thing that really is driving this is, oddly enough, EPA standards or environmental protection standards that Europeans traditionally relied on transits or SUVs to do things like haul campers or caravans or trailers. And over the last couple of years, as European environmental standards have gone up for vehicles, most SUVs have gotten smaller, more fuel efficient engines that have less torque. And so at the same time, American trucks have gotten bigger cabs, more luxurious, more powerful. So now all of a sudden there's a burgeoning market for them, a burgeoning demand for them. And Ben weighed in on this conversation this week by sending us a picture of the Ford truck plant in Kentucky that has produced so many trucks that are awaiting chips. Was that the Kentucky Speedway?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, that you can actually see all of the trucks waiting for chips so they can be sold and exported from space.
Yeah, a giant parking lot full of them.
Yo, be sure and tell the folks in Kentucky that I don't have that issue. Right.
See, I don't have that issue in my car either.
That's right.
Driving a 13-year-old Jeep. I don't have it either.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think my Lotus has all you guys beat. It was made in 1970, so the most advanced piece of electronics it came with from the factory, I think, is the points in the distributor.
I was going to say the radio.
Well, yeah, the original radio is long gone from it, but yeah,
Yeah. Well, all I know is when I find out who in my neighborhood has that stupid Toyota truck that keeps taking up a parking space and a half, me and him are going to have words. and Nimrod's might involve that bar of ivory soap that I have stashed back in a tube sock. I'm just saying.
You can take the girl out of Raban, but you can't take the Raban out of the girl.
So amen, brother. Yeah, it's definitely a challenge here, you know, because the parking spaces and the parking garages here are definitely not built for American sized vehicles. You know, my husband has the Mazda CX-5, which is a pretty good sized SUV, and there are a couple of parking space, you know, parking garages, mainly in The Hague or Amsterdam, that it's a tight fit. I mean, it's a tight fit just to get down into it, especially the one in The Hague over by Palais Noordende, which is where the king always says hey after their little thing. It's really weird because, you know, you're walking in this, like, in the area of The Hague, and you just kind of turn this corner into this residential neighborhood, and it's like, oh, hey, here's a palace. Very bizarre. But that parking garage is I mean, my car kind of struggles because, you know, my car's pretty wide to be like the size of a Jeep or something.
Well, I was looking at sorry, Missy, to interrupt, but I was looking online at European made pickup trucks. Apparently VW makes a pickup truck. And I think Mercedes has a prototype pickup truck. There's some others that we just don't see here in the States.
Yeah. They're scrambling. And even the Japanese pickup trucks typically are not made in Japan. They're only made in the United States for the States market. So and I will admit, we had a pickup truck for a number of years. We had a Ford Ranger that was bloody indestructible. In fact, a friend bought it and it's still running at 25 years old. And they are just mind-bogglingly useful.
Yes.
And so the whole concept of why it never caught on elsewhere, other than the fact it's quintessentially American, you wonder, does that extend it past the purely pragmatic elements of it's hard to park and it's hard to get fuel economy?
I also think it has to do with, in Europe, the cities are more like contained.
Yes.
Yep. You know, yep. Like if it's, I leave my little town, it doesn't like spread and sprawl out and kind of like just run into the next town. There's very clear and delineated between Alpha and Leiden and Leiderdorp, you know, but all between that is farmland. And on those provincial roads or the county roads, you know, you just put your tractor on there, or a lot of times there's an access road that runs right beside that.
Yeah.
So you don't really need a pickup truck to haul that stuff. You just hook whatever it is up to your tractor, you know, and hope that slurry tank doesn't spill, because, oh dear God, the smell.
Oh yeah.
That doesn't sound good at all.
Well, it's you know, in one way it's great because it's more environmentally friendly way to fertilize, you know. Because fun fact of the day, the second largest exporter of food behind the United States is the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Huh. Amsterdam is actually one of the world's foremost freight ports.
No, it's Rotterdam.
Rotterdam. But the Netherlands, Rotterdam. Yeah. But also because it's so damn fertile up there. There's so much food.
Well, I think we can get like 20 to 30 times the amount of potato harvest from the same amount of ground as in the United States with less water and less chemicals.
Interesting.
So,
without pickup trucks.
Those are our problems, man. We got tractors and they're like big. I mean, they're like Mondo tractors. I love them.
Paul, I think Paul was trying to say something. Sorry, Ben. No,
go ahead.
All I was going to say is you probably produce a lot more because you have layers of planning in the farmland area, like a three-story building. You got a three-story planning situation. And I'm just saying that for the heck of it.
Well, you got the three-story thing right, because a lot of our houses are three stories, you know, but it's just there's actually places you can go and, you know, it looks like a city because you see all the lights and you just drive by and you're like, holy crap, that's just greenhouses.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Dave. Good stuff. Anything else we need to say before we wrap the segment?
Well, if an F-150 loaded with Dutch potatoes leaves Amsterdam going at sorry.
How long does it take it to find the Costco sized jar of mayonnaise? Is that where you're going with that? Yeah.
That's good. All right. That's good. Let's shift gears. Thank you, Dave. Excellent stuff. I still want a pickup truck, but that's a discussion for another topic. And now we're going to switch gears to me, I guess. I've got a grinds my gears segment. So what's grinding my gears today? Can you guys, you want to guess? It's a
pickup trucks.
Blank slate. Pickup trucks? No, actually, it's car concepts and prototypes that never go to production. Those make me angry. I love looking at prototype cars. I love looking at concepts. I love walking away from them saying, oh, this is a fantastic idea. And then nothing ever happens. And that just makes me a little bit nuts. And anyway, that's what grinds my gears today.
You know, actually, what's funny is when, especially when you look at some of the concepts that don't make it to production versus some of the concepts that do.
Yeah.
There are some really great creative concepts that you see that they passed on. And you know that somebody at Chrysler said, let's pass on this really cool, incredible sports car concept to build the PT Cruiser instead.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It makes me, this is why I'm bald. This is,
yeah.
It makes me absolutely crazy.
Well, one of the things that bugs me about them is that they are such great works of automotive art. Some of them are just so incredibly cool. And most of them wind up going to the crusher.
Yeah.
Very few of the concept cars get saved. I have seen in person a number of really cool ones. Some of the really, there were some from the 50s and 60s that did get saved, thank goodness. Every now and then they tour art museums. I've been to two exhibits at the High Museum in Atlanta that featured some really cool ones. The last one I went to had the Buick Centurion from I think 58.
Yes.
Cadillac Cyclone. These are really, really famous. You look in any concept car book, anything on the history of American styling, and you'll see these. And there they were in the museum right in front of my eyes. And it was a holy grail moment. Just one of those kind of, but they're phenomenal. And I'm so glad that those got saved at least.
Yeah.
I think it should be against the Geneva Conventions to destroy any concept car because that's right. Is cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes, I'm probably going to blame a lawyer or an insurance company for why they need to be crushed or something. But it's just it just seems like an unnecessary crime against humanity to show us a cool possibility and then deny us the reality of having that.
Yeah.
So,
anyway, thank you for listening to my Grinds My Gears segment.
We're here for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. We're running. Yeah. Sorry, Misty.
I was about to say, I think this is, this is one that I think every single person around the table is like, yes, we all agree. Right. Yeah.
So we're running a little short on time. I was going to do a top five movie segment with one of us today, but to catch us up on the agenda, how about we wrap the show with the answer to our grand trivia auto question? Misty, can you fill us in here?
Yes. Okay. The question was, if the fastest vehicle produced each year was put on an infinitely straight track on the first day of the year it was produced and raced at its top speed indefinitely, which car would currently be in the lead? And the four choices were the 1967 Lambo Mira, the 2005 Bugatti Veyron, the 1987 Ferrari F40, or the 1959 Aston Martin DB4 GT.
Huh, God,
oh,
it's a hard choice. Let's give Paul first guess here because all of us are just sort of shaking our heads, and I can't make my fingers work this calculator quickly enough.
Had to be choice number four.
Say again, Paul.
Had to be choice number four.
The Aston Martin?
Yes.
It'd be the Aston Martin.
Okay. Ben, what do you think?
I'm going to go with the Lamborghini because it has a little bit of a speed advantage on the Aston Martin, but it's got a huge time advantage on the other two.
Interesting. Dave, what do you think?
I'm going to go with the Aston Martin for no other reason than I'm having James Bond hair today.
Okay. It is true, by the way. If we put this video up, everyone will have to agree. And for my choice, so Paul and Dave have said the Aston Martin. Ben has said the Lambo. The remaining choices are the Ferrari or the Bugatti.
Yeah.
I like Ben's logic for that Lambo. So I'm going to stick with that question, that answer as well. I'm going to side with Ben here and say it's got to be the Lambo.
Okay. Now, we're going to go from bottom up, and I'm going to give you the distance in miles.
Okay.
So in fourth place is the 2005 Bugatti Veyron.
Oh.
20,180,940 miles. Mm-hmm. In third place is the 1987 Ferrari F40.
Oh.
With 48,000,000. 75,734 miles. In second place is the 1967 Lambo Mira.
Oh.
70,519,032 miles. And in first place is the 1959 Aston Martin DB4 GT with 73,335,744 miles.
So Paul and Dave get this one with the Aston Martin things. We'll have a too bad we don't have consolation prizes for the rest of us or anything.
But mathematically, I'm guessing this means that Paul's Mercedes is like, you know, would be like number 7th or 8th.
Yes.
Actually, on this list, the very last one was the 2010 Bugatti Veyron Supersport with 9,565,709 miles.
That's crazy. Paul, what were you about to say?
I was just going to say, I wanted to just mention one other thing about my car.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is that the vehicle is written up in the Star magazine. Y'all familiar with the Star magazine produced by Mercedes? It's the July-August 2019 issue. And on page 10, it mentions, and Mercedes said this, I obviously can't say it. They said there is no other Mercedes in the United States on the road today with the kind of mileage my car has on.
That's amazing.
Most people when they get a million miles, they garage it. They put it up. They said they've done. And I just kept on going, and I'm at 1.2 and trucking on down. Oh, well, Mercedes Benz and on down the road. So.
Yeah,
and
I just had to say that. I brag about my car all the time. In fact, there's my business card. I don't know if you can read it or not.
There we go. Yep.
Oh, I love it.
And it also has a lot of information on the back as well, where it was purchased.
Very cool. Nice. You are driving your dream car. That's fantastic.
Exactly. Well, Paul, just to make you feel better, the car that was actually in second place, because I just picked a few out of this. I had a list of like a bunch of cars. The car that is in second place is actually the 1955 Mercedes-Benz 300 SL with 72,451,680 miles.
Wow. Wouldn't it be great to have a dollar a mile?
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Heck, I'd love a dime a mile at this point. That would be good. Yeah. So, Paul, once again, thank you for being our guest. Misty, thank you for wrangling the trivia question for the day. And good stuff. And and anything else we need to cover before we wrap the show?
Just remember that if you like what you heard, give us a shout out or a good review on Apple, iTunes, or wherever you are listening to this. If you didn't like the show today, it was entirely Paul's fault. Take it out on his new website.
That's right. I got to agree with you.
That's right. Thank you, sir. And thanks to our guests for joining us. We love it that you're part of the Thing About Cars family. In the meantime, we hope you and yours are staying safe out there. Get vaccinated. We'll see you soon. Take care.
See ya.
Later, y'all.
Sounds great.
Thank you for listening. This has been the Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.